You're listening to Hearing Our Heritage, the podcast where we preserve the voices and stories of the older generation and make them accessible to younger ears. We pay tribute to those who have paved the way and learn from their lived experiences. I'm your host, Katie Pierce.
My name is Albert Thomas Rothy. I was born August 20th, 1942 in Ogden, Utah at the McKay D Hospital.
Tom Rothy has had a very amazing life. He has five great kids, five bonus kids, many grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. He spent his childhood in Ogden, Utah, where he had lots of fun. But he also faced serious hardships in his family. He met his eternal companion, Helen Stokes, in high school, and they were married after he returned from his mission to the northern states. He received a degree in Chinese history and Chinese from Brigham Young University, and then a master's in public administration. He worked for the California Senate, as a farmer in rural British Columbia, and as a mortgage broker. Sadly, he lost his sweetheart Helen to cancer after an amazing 40 years of marriage. He later met and married his beautiful wife Becca, and they've had 16 wonderful years together. He has a rich and fascinating heritage. We'll start his story there.
My father was Albert Godfrey Rothy. His father was Leonidas Godfrey Rothy. And his father was Albert George Henry Rothy. And his father was Godfrey Rothy from Darmstadt, Germany. So that's kind of my ancestry on my paternal line.
Tom's family joined the church thanks to his great-great-grandfather on his father's maternal side.
He and his wife immigrated to the United States. He was a coal miner living in Northumberland, England. And the coal mines shut down, so they immigrated to the U.S. They lost a baby, was buried the baby at sea, and they moved to the Pittsburgh area. And one day he went to the local pub in Rock Run, Pennsylvania, and there was a Book of Mormon on the bar there. And when Sidney Rigdon had the falling out with the church, he went back to Pennsylvania, to Pittsburgh, and he started a church there. And one of his disciples was a man named William Bickerton. William Bickerton had a falling out with Sidney Rigdon, and he formed a church called the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints Bickertonites. Their headquarters were in Monongahela, Pennsylvania. And so he had left this book there. He took it and read it and joined the Bickertonites. And he became an apostle and a member of the First Presidency in the Quorum of 12 Apostles. And he just kept writing to Brigham Young. He learned more about the church and he wrote to Brigham Young. And finally, in 1886, he and his family and the whole Rock Run branch of the Bickertonites joined the church. And they had a daughter, Margaret Barnes, and she married this Brit, Robert Brown, who wasn't a member of the church. They had several children, and one of the daughters was Ruth Brown. Ruth Brown married Leonidas Godfrey Rothy. We called him LG. He let her take all the kids to church. He didn't join the church until the 1960s, just before he died. My mother, her name was Margaret Louise Williams, and she was born in Carneys Point, New Jersey. So she grew up in Elizabeth, Pennsylvania, which is where my father lived. She and her brother got ill, so he was a year back, and so he ended up in the same class as my mother. And they were co-valedictorians of their high school in Elizabeth. She also won the most beautiful girl in the high school. She was a real looker. So, of course, my dad was a football player, a track star. She was attracted to him. She was a Baptist, but attended the Presbyterian Church because my grandfather was one of the founders of the Presbyterian Church in Pennsylvania. My father was a year ahead of her, and he was LDS, but she married my dad in Pennsylvania. My oldest brother was born in McKeesport, Pennsylvania. All the rest of us were all born in Ogden. In the early phases of the Second World War, and all my dad and all his brothers and all their sisters and spouses, and there were 12, six boys and six girls, they all moved to Utah, to Ogden. Ogden had the big railroad terminal going to San Francisco, so they all came out. They're all railroaders. Sometime in that time before their older brother Scott was born, my mom joined the church. My mother was a faithful member of the church. My dad was a little wishy-washy. She loved the church. She loved the gospel. She didn't know a lot about it. She did the best she could with what she had where she was at. And they were married in the Salt Lake Temple. Then they got divorced in the 50s. And I always referred to my father as my good, bad example. So my mother basically raised me and four brothers and a sister. The oldest is Randolph Gordon Rothy, Kenneth Lee Rothy, Alan Scott Rothy, then old A.T., my sister Pamela, and my brother Richard. My mom worked for the Department of Defense at a place in Ogden. It was called Second Street. It was a big Army supply depot during the Second World War. My mother was very smart, and growing up in back east, she took like 4 or 5 years of Latin. So we could never stump her on a word. She was always correcting us on our grammar. No, you don't say it like that. Just how you say it. But she had a rough time as a mom, five boys and a girl. She passed away in 2001 at 83 of congestive heart failure. She was a good person, and all my life I've tried to help her, buying her a new washing machine or a dryer and stuff like that, but she suffered women's prejudice. She was an outstanding employee, but always the guys got the promotions. Well, and she's in her 30s. She got ovarian cancer and had surgery on that and radiation and survived. My dad bought a half acre on Canyon Road in Ogden, this half acre. So we had cherry trees and pear and peaches, and somebody had the ingenious idea to plant thorn blackberries along the back fence. Every year it was our job to whack those things down, and we hated the job. And I always remember my dad had built a clothesline. It was really long because six kids, you had a lot of clothes. And our house was a basement with a steep roof. The flooring in it was a white oak, and my father, he got the wood for free by tearing down the old railroad stop in Uinta. It had these two little stoves is all it would heat with asbestos windows in the front of them. And sometime when I'd wake up in the night and get cold, I'd go out and lie down in front of those with a blanket over me to keep me warm. So that basement house had two bedrooms and four brothers. We had two bunk beds, and it had U.S. Army with the springs with wire and a mattress on it. I mean, there weren't even slats or those springs. And my mother and my sister slept in the other bedroom. Then there was a laundry room. My brother would sleep on a fold-down couch in the front room. And I never knew I was poor. You know, I just grew up and I thought this is the way it is until I got in high school. My father, we had a big chicken coop and he had a lot of chickens and he had a big round tree stump. He'd go out there and get a chicken and lay it across that block and chop its head off and then set it down for the kids. We'd chase the chicken around the yard. And I lived in the midst of fruit orchards all the way up 12th Street, all the way up 16th Street over to the Ogden River. And so I just would hang out in a cherry tree until I had to run home because of a potential diuretic episode. But in the early 50s, my dad was a salesman selling things on the road, so he was gone a lot. One time my mom took his car with all the kids. My brother Randy was 16 at the time and had a learner's permit. So I was about 12, 11 or 12, I think, and seven of us piled in that Ford sedan. It was a pretty new car, and drove to Pittsburgh to Elizabeth to see my grandmother. My mom didn't have a driver's license, and Randy had a learner's permit. So we had a lot of fun driving through Chicago, and we would sleep outside, just pull off the road and roll out blankets and sleep. And I remember one night I woke up and this frog was had landed on my forehead. And one other night we were sleeping out and we just, all of a sudden, the ground started to vibrate and shake and everything. And a big freight train went by. We didn't realize we were right by the railroad tracks. What an adventure that was. And when we got to my grandma's house, she lived in this little apartment and had one of those big tubs, and all us kids got in there and got cleaned up and just had a wonderful time.
Unfortunately, Tom's childhood wasn't always as fun as their road trip across the states. His parents' marriage was tumultuous at best, which was something that affected him and his siblings' home life.
Then they got divorced in the 50s. I always referred to my father as my good, bad example. My father was mean. One time he threw a dish at my mother with such velocity that it stuck in the wall. Fortunately, it didn't hit my mother. And one time he got mad at my mom and she tried to get away from him. They were yelling. She was screaming, of course. And she crawled out through the front window. The windows were fairly good size. It's a high basement wall. And he was trying to stop her and she was kicking to get away from him. And she got out the window and he ran out the door and caught her in the front yard and had her down on the sidewalk. And my brother Randy and I were there. Randy was the oldest. And he was just beating her. And I ran with Randy up to the neighbors, to the Nichols, a few doors up the road. And give me your gun, I'm going to shoot him. To shoot my dad. And Nichols was smart enough, no, I won't give it to you. He finally left, and that was the last straw. And we were happy when he was gone. And he came back, and I was sitting in the front room and saw the kitchen, and there was a doorway. And my mother loved lilacs. It was in the spring, and so she had a green cookie jar, and it was full of lilacs. He got mad at her, and he threw them at her. It went through the door into the living room, and I was in there sitting on the couch listening to this, and it just skidded across the hardwood floor and hit me in the shins and spilled the water and the lilacs all over. He left, and we didn't see him for a long time after that. When I was 14 years old, and I'd gone into the Uinta Mountains with the scouts, and I came back, and when I got there, my dad was there in the kitchen. He said, you know, your mother and I have been talking, and we're thinking about getting back together. What do you think about that, Tom? And I said, well, I think if you move in, I'll move out. Because I said, I can't take any more violence. He stormed out of the house. And my mother and father were divorced like three times. And I think not long after that, he married Lorraine Armstrong and was the mother of my three half-sisters. So I grew up without a father, and so my scoutmaster, Wayne Gross and Jack Still was my scoutmaster, and just before my 12th birthday, we went into Long Meadow in the Uintas, and that created my love affair with the mountains. He was just so good. He's like a father to me. And then Bill Lucas was my explorer leader. And he had a rifle range in his basement. We would train firing 22s in his basement. So we were called the Rimfire Rangers, our explorer troop. And we were the ninth best in the United States. So when I graduated high school and went into the Army, when we went to Fort Ord, we had to go through rifle training with an M1. And I was the top shot in my company. I scored 89. As an expert marksman, and the Fort Ord record was 91, so I just about matched the record.
Tom's childhood in Ogden was full of very interesting characters, adventure, and getting into a little trouble here and there.
We loved to go over to the park to go swimming in that, and sometimes we were low on funds. And so a couple of us would just lift the bottom of the fence, but everyone would dart under the fence and jump in the pool, and there were already about 300 kids in the pool. We'd stay underwater for as long as we could. I never liked that, though. That was against my grain, but you know how kids are. We had some neighbors, the Barkers and the Nichols and the Bachelors and the Lynches, and they were tough. There was a woman in our neighborhood that nobody liked, Mae Felt. Some incident happened, and the Lynches were pretty upset with her, and so they built a pipe bomb and gave it to Oscar Baxter, and he went over there to put it on her porch. Well, the problem is he put it on the next-door neighbor's porch. It blew part of the corner of the porch off. Of course, the cops come out, and they go right past where the bomb site went, straight up to the Lynch house. And so the one time we were mad at her, too, and so the guys defecated in the paper sack and went and put it on her porch and lit it on fire. Rang the doorbell and ran off. She came out to stomp on it. That was how we'd get even with her. And on her front porch, she had a shelf with rocks, and you'd go by and she'd throw them at the kids.
Thankfully, not all of Tom's neighbors were trying to blow each other up.
I had good neighbors. The Mittens were the favorite. Lynn Mitten was my real good friend. He was the age of my brother Scott, but Lynn would let me hang out with him, and Lynn was just a super athlete. We had a lot of fun, and we decided to make a big parapet or something with logs and really high. It was like 25 feet high, and we cut down all our neighbors' trees to do it. Oh, it was not too smart. He goes out there, and all his poplars are gone. The cops weren't happy about that either, and we had to make restitution. One time, my neighbor Gene Priest, his dad, built just a super neat tree house out in a big black walnut tree. We'd go and hang out there, and he thought, well, this tree house's pretty neat. Why don't we make an underground? So we started digging out, and we dug a big hole. Then we put all these tree branches and logs and old doors and piled all the dirt on it. And then we had little tunnels that went around in his backyard. Well, we thought that was pretty good and got that all finished. And, well, what do we do now? Oh, well, Dad Black has moved out of his house. It's just abandoned now, and it's got all those window panes on the back of the house. So he broke every one of them out of it, just throwing rocks. Of course, they called the police on us then. Well, when the police came, we all went back underground. The police were too fat to get down the little tunnels, so they couldn't do us. Finally, my friend Lynn Mitten, he said, I'll go out. Lynn was just tough. And so they took him downtown. He said, are you the only one? Yeah. So he got booked for that. We had to pay restitution. We helped Lynn. It was another one of those days where, guys, I don't know, we need a good adventure. So they said, well, let's go down and float down the Ogden Rivers on inner tubes. So we went over there, and it had been the old Ogden dump. They had big slabs of concrete and old curb and gutter there, and the water just boil and then take a hard right turn. Well, right where it split and then came together there was an island in the middle of the river of rock, gravel, and so, and there were willows growing along on that side of the river, and it was running high and fast. The water was up to the bottom of the bridges over the river, and everybody ran and jumped over there. And of course, I was petrified. And Lynn Mitten said to me, come on, Tom, jump. I'll grab you. And so I got back on the island and ran as hard as I could and got over to the edge of the river and leaped and didn't make it. And it was Lynn Mitten just instantly wrapped a bunch of willows around his arm and leaped into the river and grabbed me by the arm. Saved my life.
It was during his teenage years that Tom met a girl who would become very important to him.
Oh, was a junior at Ben Lomond High School, and my friends, Art Jones and Dave Slater and them, came over and say, "Hey, Tom, we're going to go crash a party up at Peg Leiniger's. So you want to go with you?" "No, I can't. I've got a date." "Art Jones, you're going out with Chris Kotok, aren't you?" I said, "Yes." And he said, "Oh, I'm going to call her." "No, Art, don't call her." And I had been having a discussion with my mom about using the car, and she was reluctant to let me take the car. So finally, I just called Chris and said, "Look, can't take the car." And so I went and jumped in their car, and off we went to Peg Leiniger's. And when I got up there, there was this tall blonde girl sitting crossway in a chair. I never spoke two words to her. And afterwards, I said, "Dave, who is that gal in that room that I was sitting at, that blonde gal?" He said, "Well, that's Helen Stokes. Would you like to go out with her?" And I said, "Yeah, I would." And he said, "Well, I'll line you up." So he called Helen, and she said, "Yeah, I'll go out with him." And so I took Helen to the North Ogden Steak Dance. That was the first date we had. I still remember she had on a red turtleneck sweater with long sleeves, and it was because it was January, and a plaid skirt, A-line skirt. Had a blast. So we dated for quite a while, and she was in the 10th grade. She was vice president of the sophomore class. Then the next year, she was elected vice president of the junior class. The next year, she's elected vice president of the high school. She was mellow. She could sing. She could play the piano. She could paint. She just all around, down-to-earth, good girl. She was president of Otiaqua, which was the biggest sorority at Weber State. Everybody liked Helen because she just didn't, she wouldn't say anything bad about anybody, unlike her husband. So I dated her into her junior year, and then she said, "Tom, I think we ought to date somebody." I'd always tell my kids, well, she dumped me. "I didn't dump you," she said, but and I don't blame her. She was at Ogden High. I was at Ben Lomond. We were competitors, and we'd go out maybe once every 3 months or something like that. We were just still good friends. And I graduated high school and went up to Weber State. And after that, I went into the Army National Guard and was sent to Fort Ord, California in 1961. I went to Fort Sill, Oklahoma, and was trained in the 105 and 155 howitzers. But I was the mess driver the last 6 weeks. I had a real cushy job in August of 1961. Captain told me to take the truck to the motor pool to check on it. I went over there, and the mechanic told me to check on the radiator to make sure it was okay for the summer heat. I'd never really been trained. It was called the deuce and a half. I'd never been trained that it didn't have a safety radiator cap. In order to get up to the radiator, you had to stand on the front bumper. And I turned the cap. The water just blew out and hit me in the face. Burned my right eardrum, and I've had trouble with my eardrum ever since.
After being discharged from the Army, Tom was ready to serve a mission for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
I had my interviews for the mission. You had to be interviewed by a general authority, but I waited and waited. All my friends got their calls and were all leaving. And finally I called Salt Lake. I said, "Why haven't I received my call?" "Well, because you had that ruptured eardrum and we needed you to clear that up." Well, I went to the VA and they said, "Oh, it's okay." So I got the clearance, and then I got a call to the Northern States, and I left for my mission in January of 62, and Helen came to that. I was dating a girl then named Pat Austin. She married another guy while I was on my mission. But November of 1963, I was in Madison, Wisconsin, and I got a letter, and I still have it. It has like six forwarding addresses on the front from Helen, all these different places I'd been. And she had enclosed a picture she had just gotten done at Paul's and JCPenney in Ogden. And she looked pretty dang cute, I thought. But I thought, wow, it's almost the end of November. And so I had 2 months left on my mission. So one night, my companion, he went to bed, and I sat up and got out a yellow legal notepad and wrote down pros and cons of all the girls I'd dated. I just thought back then it was nothing to be married at 21, 22. So I thought I'm going to go home and I could be married soon. So I wrote her back. So we started corresponding the last couple months of my mission. When I went on my mission, we took the train, the Rio Grande Railroad, to Chicago. That's how we got out. And when I came home, one of my companions, his father, he had him buy a new Chrysler and drive it home. Me and another elder, the three of us, drove home from Chicago. And I always remember it was a warm January day, must have been about the 26th or something. And I came around Washington Boulevard and then it curves and goes straight north and looked out at that Washington Boulevard and I thought, boy, I'm home again. So that night, my good friend Dave Slater, I had called him and told him I was home. And he said, well, let's go see Helen. She was attending the Y and she came home that night. And I went out and knocked on the door and she opened the door and she had her hair all up in curlers. She was so mad. And I said, hey, look, I don't want to bother you. I just wanted to say hi that I'm back in town and I'll be in touch with you. She said, okay. And we left. And so the next night, I think we went out. The old flame was rekindled. And in March, just a couple months later, at my brother Scott's wedding, I was in the line and she was my brother Scott's bridesmaids. And so the guys were first. And I said, you see that blonde way down there in the bridesmaid? Yeah, that's the girl I'm going to marry. So they'd go down there. She's just laughing her head off. That guy said, he's going to marry you. So we had a lot of fun and went to a Valentine's dance. I think it was in April at the Ogden Country Club. And when we got into the parking lot, I pulled out the engagement ring that I had and asked her to marry me. So it was a fun night. She was just walking around with the ring. And she had one more quarter to get her bachelor's degree in elementary education. So, and I was attending Weber State. She was going to the Y and I was always going down. And I remember I'd fallen asleep and was way over on both sides. And it was about 4 a.m. There were no cars. And I woke up and I made it back and I worked for the IRS in Ogden. So I had to be there at 6. Boy, as soon as it was break time, I'd just throw myself down on the mailbags. They'd say, Tom, wake up. So I was going to Provo a lot. And we got married in August. August the 12th, 1964, I decided to take her on our honeymoon to Canada. We had a little gray Volkswagen. And so we drove up to Logan, then we went up to Missoula, Montana, then up to Banff National Park, and we went up to Lake Louise. And I rented a canoe and took her out on Lake Louise, canoed across the lake, and we got way over to where the glacier comes down the lake. And then I looked at my watch. Oh, gosh, we got to be back or they'll charge us for another rental. She just laughed. Oh. And when we were on the trip, the sync gear on the transmission, the Volkswagen, went out so that the gear wouldn't stay in gear. So Helen or I would have to put their leg over in front of it to hold the gear shift in gear. We got to Jack's, we stayed at the Frost Motel at the time. And we kept the receipt and Helen had put it in a scrapbook and it was $7. Those were the days, my friend, I thought they'd never end. But we got back and I wanted her to finish school, so I didn't start that fall. She came back and went to Weber State. We got a little apartment up on 26th Street in Ogden. Our rent was $60 a month. That included utilities, so it was pretty inexpensive. And my brother Scott and I got the idea that we'd go cut down Christmas trees. And we set up a Christmas tree stand and sold those Christmas trees. That's how we made our money for Christmas. But Helen and I, we said, you know, we just don't have that much money. So we limited our spending. I can't remember if it was $5 or $10 each. And so I bought her a present. And she was so upset because this present I got her was big. It's a big box. And she just had this little tiny thing and she couldn't figure out what it was that I had bought her. It's for our Christmas tree. We had the last pinyon pine that we couldn't sell because the back was no good. So we put it in the quarter. So that Christmas morning, she gets up there. She just couldn't wait to open that box. And she opened up, and it was a box of Kotex. I think she laughed for half the morning. But I'd do that. She said, how did you dare go to the counter and buy that? That was always our big joke. We'd laugh at Christmas time about that. One day I'd gone over to the church early and she'd come in and I said, Helen, what's the matter? She said, I backed the car out of the driveway and hit the neighbor's car. It didn't do much damage, but it was, and I immediately said to her, are you all right? Then she burst into tears. Tom, we're worried about me in the car. Oh, that makes me so happy. It's the only decent thing I think I did that year. But she was just nice. So she went on and finished her schooling and got a job. And we got our first check. The salary was $4,000 a year. So the check was for like $325 less the taxes. So we went out and spent $125 on groceries. We came home and said, what should we have for dinner? We decided we'd have hot dogs. Then we moved to Bountiful and she taught. There's a brand new elementary school called Meadowbrook Elementary. And I transferred to the University of Utah. And getting married, I went from a B student to a straight A student. And I wanted to study Chinese and Chinese history and that. And the U was very weak. So I thought I'd go to the Y. And one of my old missionary companions, Don Miller, he lived right in the apartment below us on Second South in Salt Lake. And he said, well, I'd like to get down to the Y too. So we would drive down to BYU every day for spring semester from Salt Lake. And I don't know how it came about, but I thought I should go to a really good program. So Helen came home and said, Tom, they're trying to hire teachers in Hawaii. And I said, oh, that sounds fun. The University of Hawaii had the East-West Center. And so she interviewed and was hired. And so we moved to Hawaii in August of 66. She taught at Manoa Elementary. And I went to the University of Hawaii and it was $100 a semester. Sweet, they had no out-of-state charges. And so I took classes there and did really well. I took intensive first and second year Chinese in a semester. I did pretty well. I got A's there. And Helen, her principal, was the commander of the Japanese battalion during the Second World War, Yokohama. And he was strict. And she'd come home just terrified. Oh, Tommy, I have to have my days planned out for a month in advance. He wants to see him and every day what I'm going to teach that day, what time. So she taught, and afterwards she said, Tom, it saved my life, all the rest of the teaching, because I was just always so prepared. It just taught me to be prepared. And she had 34 students, and she said one day she came in, she opened the closet to get something out of the closet, and there was a big spider. Pretty soon the kids started coming in. She had a little kid named Jimmy, who was Japanese, said, oh, Jimmy, when I got in the closet, she was so casual. There was one of those big spiders. Would you take care of it? Sure, Mrs. Rothy. And he runs, opens the door, grabs it, runs, opens the door to the class and throws it out on the grass. She said, those kids, they're so used to it. We first got there and people said, you need to do things a little different in Honolulu because of the cockroaches. So Helen and I are there in bed the first week we're there. And she told me, Tom, I can't sleep. I can hear the cockroaches running around in the cupboards. And I said, oh, well, we better do so. So we start putting our cereal, everything that was in a metal container, we put in the fridge at night. She would just, Tom, there's a cockroach. So I'd have to get these cockroaches. Every day before I'd leave to go up to the University of Hawaii, I'd take a canister bomb, cockroach killer, and light it. So every night we'd have to come and sweep up the cockroaches and get rid of them. One night we were lying on our bed there, and it was a cockroach on the ceiling, and it was wobbling. All of a sudden it stopped, and then it fell, and it was falling right at her. And she just rolled off the bed, picked up her shoe, swept it off the bed, and wham, wham, wham. I mean, she was completely recharged on bugs by the time it ended. They shipped our Volkswagen over there, and in January and February it would rain and we'd go out and our car was parked and the water would be up to the running board and it wouldn't start because it's just so wet because it was air cooled. So I'd tell her, okay, honey, get in the car. And so I'd get it, push it up out on the street, and I'd push it and I'd say, okay, pop the clutch, and off she'd go up to school. That happened a lot, all that rain. But right behind our apartment was a coconut tree. And we'd be sitting in there and all of a sudden hear, oh, a coconut just dropped. And I'd go out there and there was a steel rod sticking out of the ground. And I'd been over to the Polynesian Culture Center and learned how to husk a coconut. So I'd just husk it on that steel rod really quick and take it in. I'd crack that thing open and eat all the coconut. Well, the Hawaiians told us, if you squeeze coconut and you get the milk, it's a laxative. If you eat the meat, it isn't. I just loved it so much, and I'd forget about it, and I'd eat a whole coconut. Oh, man, I was locked up for a week, and oh, I was in so much pain. But we had a wonderful year there. Then I got a National Defense Foreign Language Fellowship to the University of Michigan, to the CIC Institute. So Helen's parents flew over there and stayed with her. And until I left in May, her school went to June. So I flew back to Ann Arbor, Michigan, went to summer school, and our phone bill every month was $100 a month calling. So we spent a miserable summer while I was at the CIC Institute. And a lot of the students that were there were really smart, really good. And the teacher asked us when we first got there, have any of you used the John DeFrancis school book for language? And I raised my hand and said, yes, that's what I use at the University of Hawaii. Oh, okay. Anybody else? No, nobody else. The final on that exam that year, the night before the final, I was just looking at the book and I thought, oh boy, because it was oral. Some people have the knack for language and some don't. I'm one of the don'ts. But the night before, I read this story in the third year Chinese book in Chinese. And so she starts talking and I thought, oh, that's that story that I just read last night. There's how the Lord helps you out. I got an A in the class. I got the highest score, not because I understood what she was saying. I understood what she was saying because I knew what she was talking about. Went to BYU that fall, and Helen came down and taught, and I graduated from the Y in 68 with the Bachelor of Arts in Chinese History and Chinese. I had a double major, Asian Studies, and I was thinking I'd go to graduate school. But then when I got looking into graduate school and some of these guys wanted 3 and 4 languages, and I thought, Tom, that's not in your wheelhouse. I took the law school exam and passed and was accepted at the University of Utah Law School. And I was going through one semester of that, and I dropped out, and I had received a scholarship to the Y to get a master's in public administration.
Tom and Helen then welcomed their first child, a little girl named Heather.
She had the baby on January 26, 1969. So we'd been married that year. It would have been 5 years. And the kids would say, why did you wait so long, Dad? And I said, well, you see your mother over there? Yes. Well, she's my eternal companion. Who are you? Said, you're going to run off just like I did and get married, and you're going to be someplace else. So who do I need to take care of first? Who's number one? She is. And don't forget it. So that was the beginning of our children. That fall, I worked on my master's degree. And Helen was a stay-at-home mom. And we lived at Wymount Terrace, 3C Wymount Terrace. And we had one of those two-bedroom apartments with all utilities for $75 a month. And so I graduated the top of my class in my master's program, because I finally learned when I got into graduate school that university was to teach you to think. And so I would start reading. We would have teams. And so I started reading. I'd read the papers the other group had written, and you would have a critique meeting. And I would read their footnotes, and I'd read the footnotes of the footnotes. And so I would go to class super prepared. Anyway, I graduated, and I got offered a job with the Nebraska legislature in Lincoln. And then I got offered a job with the California legislature in Sacramento. And I thought, well, do I want to go back and freeze my Arkansas off or go to California with the orange trees? And so worked for the California legislature till 1976. When we moved there in the middle of May of 1970, Helen was expecting number two. And we got down there, and my insurance was to take effect July 1. Our son Chris was born June 30th, and it was $600 was the fee, and we were so broke. And a friend of mine that I worked with there, he loaned me the money. But so that was our number two child, June 30th, 1970, which is actually the birthday of my father, but he was born in 1916. I worked there in the education department, analyzing the Department of Education's budgets, and I had the schools for the deaf and blind, the schools for the neurologically handicapped, and among other things, and enjoyed it. Had some good friends there. I had a friend, he had graduated from Stanford, Stuart Schultz. He said, Rothy, I'd love to see you with long hair and drunk. I said, that's not going to happen. But anyway, I appreciate your desire. While we were up there, Amy was born in 1973 in Kaiser Permanente in Carmichael, California, just a suburb of Sacramento. And then 2 years later in 75, Laura was born in California, Kaiser Permanente. So in 1975, we decided to take a vacation in our big new 75 Ford green van to Canada to see a friend of mine, Doug Zollinger, who was my MTC companion. And I built a platform in the back behind the second seat so we could put our luggage underneath it. Then we put a big foam pad and blankets in that so the kids could go snooze if they wanted. We have some really great pictures.
That trip to Canada led Tom's family to move to British Columbia for 5 years.
Oh, so beautiful. Pine trees, rolling hills, the crops. They had 17,000 acres. I just fell in love with it, and I said, Doug, is there a place I could come up here and farm? And he said, yeah, I'll show you how to do it. So I went back and worked that year in 75, 76 for the California legislature, and then I resigned, and I moved to Canada. I was gone for 2 or 3 months, and we sold our house in Elk Grove. We'd bought a home in Elk Grove, had it built for $39,200. Well, wouldn't people in California love that? But we made a pretty good money off of that. And we'd bought a home in Salt Lake, too, on DeSoto Street, which was just above the state capitol, and sold that and made some money. So we went to Canada and went through all the rigmarole to become landed immigrants. It took us 3 years. So we went on up to Canada in 76, and then Helen had a miscarriage in between Laura and Annie. Annie was born in 78, and we were there in the hospital in Fort St. John, and it was just a big, long, narrow room. This doctor came in and examined her and said, oh, it looks like you're still a ways away, Helen. I'll be back in a while. And so she went out, and the nurse went out, and all of a sudden Helen said, I'm having this baby, and I'm having it now. The nurse was just about out the door, and she heard her, and I yelled, nurse, you better get back here. She went to the door, yelled, doctor, get back here. And the doctor came running back, but by then the baby was out on the bed. So Anne was born in a rush. Fort St. John, British Columbia, Canada. She's a Canuck. But Anne was born August 1st, 1978. That was my brother's birthday.
Mm-hmm.
we moved to a different farm. Tim and Doug and I, we got a hold of about 2,500 acres along the Peace River in bottomland where the soil was as deep as you could plow. We decided we were going to grow canola oil. So we poured all this money into it and had 2,500 acres. We thought we'd get 30 bushels to the acre, which at the time was selling about $7 a bushel. So it would have been a lot of money had it worked out, but we got it planted and everything, and it came up and the fields were just gorgeous, blue and yellow. And we thought, oh baby, this is gonna be so great. Didn't rain again till August. We were just sick. Maybe the Lord wanted to kick me out of Canada, I don't know. So the crop came in at 7 bushels to the acre instead of 30. So I just told my partners, look, if this crop fails, if the good Lord's going to slap me upside the head, I'm done. I had a master's degree in public administration. I said, I'm going to go do something that I can support my family.
But before farming didn't work out, Tom had plenty of wild experiences.
We had a 54-inch Vibra shank. They're a cultivator, and they have a curved bar, and then they call it a web footer. Every once in a while, those duck feet would get caught on each other. So I had a small sledgehammer. I'd go out and bang them, and they'd bang. And one day I did it, and I had on a pair of heavy leather gloves, and they slapped me on the arm. I have a big indentation on my arm here. It hit me so hard, it just numbed me. I went into the doctor's office. The glove really saved my thumb. She said, oh, we need to give you a tetanus shot. So she got the tetanus shot to give me a shot in the arm, and she stabbed it, and it bent the needle. Because working on the farm, just low body fat at the time. One time I was swathing the barley. I found out bears love barley. And of course, it's with 17,000 acres, a section is a mile square. And it was pines all around us. And there were 5 bears in the field. And I'd come down swathing. The bears had run over into the woods. I'd go by, they'd run back over and just graze on this stuff. One day I was combining a field, and this moose walked into the field. So I had my 30-06 with me. So I just opened the swather door and shot this moose, and I had to get it back to the farm and everything. And one other occasion, there was a guy from Delta, Utah that would go up there with beehives, and the battery on this, the electric fence, has gone dead. So Doug and I decided to go out there one night with our 30-06 in the pickup truck. And we were sitting there, and there was a big area of oats, and it was a full moon. So the oats were just gleaming white like a field of snow. And these bears were in there. All of a sudden, they all stood up on their haunches. So we looked, and down in the oats was this big black bear coming through the oats. And every one of those ran to the edge, leaped over that fence. It was at least 6 feet high. They just leaped over and ran into the woods and ran away. And that bear came up there and jumped over the fence and just, boom, it hit a stack of those hives. And they just gorged themselves on honey. All of a sudden, Doug just rolled down the window and shot it right through the throat. And then we turned the truck around and I shot a bear. So later on, we skinned them, but Doug skinned his head and took the whole skeleton and that and threw it in the woods, and we could never find it. A guy came out and said to us, where's the skull? You've got to have the skull to measure for the Boone and Crockett record. Doug said, we went out in the woods and looked all through there, and there was no trace of that carcass. And the guy told me, he said it would have been the biggest black bear ever shot in British Columbia. Those were the adventures I had in British Columbia. The branch there was fantastic. My wife and I was the young men's president. She was the young women's president. I was home teaching, ministering now down in Taylor, a little town by us. And There was a family there that moved up there from Tremont. They're inactive. And I said to the kids, if I came and got you, would you come up to young men and young women? Yeah, we would. So I went down and picked them up, drove them up to Fort St. John. It was about 10 miles south, and I never took them again. People from the branch, I'll take them. Oh, I'll get them. I'll bring them. I'll go get them. Just great people. All of them were married in the temple, and all of them served missions. My wife started teaching school up there, and she taught at a little town called Tom's Lake. There were a lot of Indians, Beaverhead Indians, the Doig Reserve, and there was another reserve south of Fort St. John, and she taught second grade there. And she had a little kid in her class. His name was Johnny Standing by the Road. And I just, when the school year ended, that was right when we were getting ready to move back to Utah. And this woman, his mother, came up to Helen and said, Helen, you're the first teacher that's ever taught these kids. Helen just had a good reputation. She would never say anything derogatory to anybody. She was such a good example. I was such a needful student to learn from her. After 3 years, I learned that if God's against the farmers, I'm out of this thing. So I got out, and one of the members of our branch there, the Fort St. John branch, he owned a company called Leach's Tire. And he asked me if I'd like to work for him until I could sell everything on my farm equipment and go back to the States. After that year, several of our friends, Doug Barr and Tim Jones and Doug Zollinger, all basically got out of the farming business. We all went to work for Leach's Tire. Then they decided to buy the Leach's Tire in Dawson Creek. And then they bought Chetwynd, another Leach's store. And so I went over there to manage it, and I enjoyed it, but it was terrible hard. Had a lot of theft. And the way it was set up, it just was troublesome. So one day, Helen had said to me, look, I'll go to Canada for 5 years, but I want our kids raised in the States. So I said, okay. So in 1981, I was sitting in church there in Fort St. John, and I just got the impression that we should move. And I leaned over to her and I said, honey, I just received the impression that we should go back to the States. So I'll just quit the partnership, because they had plenty of guys that could manage it. And so not long after that, we put our house up for sale. And not long after that, one of the partners came down from Fort St. John with Gary, one of the partners that he had before I'd gone to work there. And he said, we're going to let Gary run this Dawson Creek operation. And I said, oh, okay. When do you want to do that? And he said, well, today. He's going to take over today. Well, that's okay, great. So I pulled my keys out of the pocket to the truck and gave them to him. And unbeknownst to them, I'd already sold my house. And when they went back, Doug and Tim and, well, Doug Barr said, well, how'd he take it? And they said, shocking. He just like, oh, okay. It's like nothing. And I was going to be telling them that I was leaving. So they saved me the trouble and they bought me out. So I just look at my life and I see the Lord's hand in a lot of things where he just set it up. So we moved back to Ogden, found a home in Ogden, South Ogden. My kids started at school there and we had all five kids. That was 1981. We moved there in April. So the kids finished. Heather was in the sixth grade, Chris the fifth, and Amy was third, I think. So they went to this elementary school. And of course, the kids grew up on the metric system in Canada. So right at the end of the year, they teach the metric system. Heather raised her hand and she said, that's not right. Finally, the teacher just said, Heather, will you teach us the metric system? And so Heather did. But we finally found a home that summer, moved in, and all the kids started then. Heather went to South Ogden Junior High. Marlon Elementary was the elementary school just down the street from us. And we moved in, the 80th Ward was right across the street from us. And so I was in the high priest group and they'd have us get up and speak. And so I got up there to speak and I had on bell-bottom trousers, a green plaid jacket, some funky tie. And I'm looking at everybody in the class there with the high priest. They were all in dark suits, white shirts. I just was telling them my adventures. And then I looked at myself and glanced at them and I thought, Tom, you really do march to the beat of a different drum. And after the class was over, we were walking down the hall to the sacrament meeting. And this guy named Sherm Smith came up and he put his arm over my shoulder and he said, Tom, I wish I had your guts.
At this time, Tom was working as a stockbroker for A.G. Edwards.
Eventually, my neighbor, Norm Frost, he said, Tom, why don't you come to work for me so you can make some money? And he was in the mortgage business. And I said, oh, gosh, I'm building my clientele with A.G. Edwards and as a stockbroker. And, oh, come on, you're not making any money over there. I said, why don't you come over and you can talk with Helen and me. So he came over one Sunday afternoon and we sat out on our porch and he explained the mortgage business. So I tell him, said, well, okay, let's do it. So I went to work for them down there. He gave me a $3,000 salary to start out. And his bosses in San Diego said, why'd you give this guy so much money? He said, because he needs it and he deserves it. And he'll do well. And they said, we just want you to lock loans. And so I just started locking loans. And then eventually I started working on taking loan applications in August of 85. That fall, I came up and opened an office in Ogden, moved back to Ogden. The first loan I did was for 12% on a $75,000 FHN Bountiful. I just concentrated on that and people started calling me up. Oh, yeah, let's do that. Well, it just so happened that was the beginning. I mean, there were a few glitches, but basically interest rates kept declining. So these people just kept getting cheaper and cheaper. And the next thing I knew, I was getting a lot of loans. And the first year I worked for Norm, I became the top producer in the state. One year, my best year, 93, I did 342 loans that year. I was second highest in the company nationwide. By then, I had about three or four loan officers working for me. So I had a good time there, and then the company got sold out to Chase. So I was recruited by someone else and went to work for them for a few years. And finally, so after 23 years in the mortgage business, I got out.
In the midst of his career, Tom was also busy raising his five kids with Helen. They had Heather, Chris, Amy, Laura, and Anne.
Heather was, as I said, she was the school teacher. She's a kind of take charge sort of person, a good decision maker, fabulous mother. She was the Sterling Scholar in drama and debate at Bonneville High School. She can be very argumentative, I mean, in the good sense of the term. Well, Heather was going to the Y, and for a couple of years, Helen, I didn't know. She was taking all-night classes because she forgot to get enrolled. She was doing summer Pioneer Trek and all kinds of things going on, and she finally settled down and got a degree in special education. Chris was, from the very beginning, when he was about 5 years old, maybe four, we were in the house and he had sucked these middle fingers. And he was looking at me, he pulled his fingers out and he said to me, Dad, do you think God just has a big power panel? And he says, thunder, lightning, you know, whatever kind of activity. And we bought a computer when he was in about the eighth or ninth grade and he just took to it. So he went and took programming. And so he came back, started programming the computer. He'd put passwords in so his sisters couldn't use it. Dad, Chris has got a password. We can't use the computer. So he was very good. Then he was the Sterling Scholar, General Sterling Scholar for Bonneville High School when he was a senior. He got A's in everything. So did his sister, Heather. One time she said, I can't figure this out. She was asking me, which I was terrible in math. I said, well, let's ask Chris when he gets home. So I asked Chris the question. He said, well, what's the concept you're working on? I said, you mean their concepts? He said, well, it's this. So he worked out the problem, said, this is the answer. He said, well, I worked out the problem, but I got the same answer. And he looked at it and he said, oh, yeah, you just did it another way. So, I mean, they were both really clever. So I said to Chris, he got a real high score on the ACT. And I said, well, maybe you ought to look at an Ivy League school. I didn't think I could afford to pay his way there. So he looked into it, and they had a Naval ROTC scholarship at the University of Pennsylvania. So he was accepted and went in there as the commander. He ended up his last year as the commandant of the ROTC unit at Penn. Amy, we moved in like June of 1981, and she was in school there. And the first day of school that fall, all these girls were out on the front lawn waiting for her because she was so kind and soft-spoken. Everybody wanted to be her friend. That year in the class, I think third grade, she said they needed to make a presentation in front of the class. And so I said, well, here's a great poem called Ozymandias that you should learn. And so she got it. Kids got up. I had a little duck and the duck went quack. And she gets up there out in the desert, half buried in the sand, a shattered visage lies, whose wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command. So she quotes this. And the kids, she said, their mouths open. And the teacher said, wow, that was really good, Amy. So later on, when Amy went to school, to the Y, she went to the Jerusalem Center. And so they went into Egypt, and they went to this place, and the Egyptian guide said, now this is the statue that Percy Bysshe Shelley wrote the poem Ozymandias. Do any of you know that? Amy said, well, I know it. He said, can you quote it? And so she quoted it out in the desert of this Percy Bysshe. The Egyptian guide, she said, was just shocked that she would know that. But she said, Dad, it was so neat to have had that poem and to see that. So she had an enjoyable time there, and she was very popular. One time we went out to New York and she said, I've got to do something. This TV isn't right. And we just bought this a little while ago. So she said, I got to call the store. So she calls, well, I don't want this TV. You've got to come back. You've got to come and get it. It doesn't work right. So no, I won't accept that. She just gave him the New York state of mind. And Helen and I were both, whoa, is this Amy? She became New Yorkerized. But just always fun, very supportive, just really great. Laura was our accident looking for a happening. I mean, she'd be running down the road, out in the road with the little doll buggy. Fell down and they had those sharp edges, cut way up one leg and gashed it open and just all kinds of things. But she was the spitfire. She just zest for life and will go for just about anything you want to dream up. She said, Dad, can we go shopping? Let's go down to Nordstrom. I said, you better marry somebody who's got a lot of money because you got a Nordstrom state of mind. And since then, she's become so frugal. And she had dated Whit Church, her husband, in high school. And I liked Whit. And I just thought he was a solid kind of guy. And she was dating this guy and that guy and dated even one of Whit's companions from this Poland mission. That really got Whit. But she worried, said, Daddy. I said, what about Whit? And so they went down to St. George, and that was the first time she'd really talked with him after he came home from his mission. So I guess something just clicked. They've just had a great marriage. She's a good husband, and Laura's just solid. Has done such a good job with her kids. Anne got married on the 21st of November, 2003, and just a month and a half later, her mother died. So Anne really had a difficult time. She didn't have her mother to talk to in those first year of marriage and no mother there when she's giving birth. But she's been resilient, and Jess has been a good husband for her. And she's Amy's comedian. Anne just makes Amy laugh because she's so sarcastic. But she said, I had all these children so that Jess would play with them instead of me. But I mean, she just said it facetiously. But Anne was just steady, very supportive, very just good with her kids, does everything for them. Anne does interior design. And everybody, even Laura, graduated in art. And Laura says, when I need pictures or anything situated, I call Anne. Anne, come over. She said, Anne has the eye. So Amy calls her, Anne, come out here to help me redecorate the house. So Anne's just got a real good eye, and she has a tremendous sense of humor. She's just the jokester of the family.
Helen and Tom had built a fantastic life together with those five remarkable kids. Tragically, everything changed in 2003.
Helen and I had gone up to Canada because Anne was working in Skagway, Alaska for the summer. We decided to make a trip to Skagway. I was working for Axiom Mortgage at the time. Still had a good business and it was a lot of fun, but Helen was not feeling well. So when we got back, she went to see the doctor, and the doctor thought she had infected lymph nodes. And so he put her on medication, and she said a few days later, doctor, this isn't helping. So she went back, and he said, well, let's put you on a particular drug that's really powerful. So she went on that drug, and still said, well, you better come in. Let's do an echo scan, see. So they came in, and I was sitting there in the room when the guy was doing the echo. I could see these big black bulges. So she had gone back into the doctor, and the doctor said, you better bring your husband with you. So he went over there and said, we think it might be lymphoma, but you need to do a biopsy. And so we went out of the doctor's office, IHC there in Ogden. And I said to Helen, let's call Dr. Mosinger right now. He's an ENT, and let's get a biopsy done immediately. So we called right there, standing out in the parking lot. She had it scheduled for like 2 days later, and she went over there. Dr. Mosinger lived in our ward. And it's funny, because right at that time, when we were out there leaning against the car and they said it was lymphoma, the spirit told me, Helen's life is over. I was just shocked. And Dr. Mosinger stopped by, and he could hardly speak, because he finally said, Helen, it's pancreatic cancer. So she started chemotherapy, and she lived for 16 months in one day. She was diagnosed with cancer on Friday the 13th. And they had one pancreatic cancer drug that was really quite effective, and the tumor shrank back about 50%. But the doctor, the oncologist, said it'll come back. So in August of 2003, 11 months later, the tumors were coming back, and Dr. Beck said, we'll put you on this other drug. And so she got a little better, and she had gone in February to Cornell University. Laura and her husband were there. She came back and she said, it was so miserable for me. So then that September, Amy was expecting Samantha, and Helen was not in real good shape then. And she told Amy, I can't come. One day in December, my brother Scott in Findlay, Ohio, called me and he said, well, how's Helen doing? Is jaundice? And that's what they told us, they would get jaundice. And I said, well, no. And that morning I'd been in the bathroom and I was looking at Helen. I thought, boy, she looks like she had a great tan in November or December. And when he said that to me, I said, oh my gosh, Scott, I got to go. And I hung up and I went and I said, Helen, I got to take you to see Dr. Beck immediately. She told me, I was so thankful you said that. She just didn't complain, just grin and bear it. So that was about the Friday the 13th of December. Heather invited us down to her house in West Jordan for Christmas. So we went down, and she was doing pretty good that night. And then in the morning when she woke up, I said, Heather, I'm sorry, we've got to go. I got to get her back to the hospital in Ogden. So we got her in the car and drove straight to the hospital, and she would have died that day on Christmas Day if I hadn't gotten her back there. And took her into the x-rays, and they did these x-rays and said, well, gosh, that's different. What's the deal on that? The gallbladder, it was glowing. the tumors had closed up the gallbladder exit. So all that cancer treatment that's glowing, it can't escape the gallbladder. And so they hospitalized her on Christmas Day. The nurse said, "Do you think we ought to call hospice?" I said, "Honey, look, don't you remember Dr. Beck said that there was no cure, no operation?" "No, I just felt for sure that it would." I said, "Well, I won't call hospice until I talk to Dr. Beck, her oncologist." So we got Dr. Beck on the phone, and I was sitting there, and yes, and her voice just got weaker and weaker. And so on about the 27th or 28th of December, I took her home, and we had a bed at the end of our bed in the master bedroom, and I would have to change her sheets and do everything. And I look back on it, I just say, it was one of the greatest times in our marriage. Friends would come to see her, and one of our good friends, Linda West, I went out, walked into the door and said, "Tom, I came over here to console Helen." And she consoled me. "Helen is so awesome." I said, "I agree." But finally she said to me one day, "Tom, I can't see anybody else. The kids all came." I called the kids and they came out about a week before she died. About 2 weeks before she died, I was in bed. And so it was in January of 2004. And all of a sudden, I saw this waving curtain like mother of pearl. And I saw these, I think there were six or eight men, it looked like, in white clothes with black hair standing on the other side of the veil. And there was, in the middle of them, was this woman with just blonde hair. I thought, wow, what a contrast. I just sat up in bed. I thought the angels had come to get her. I sat up, and there she was, sitting there. And then Saturday, I was in bed, and it was coming on morning. And all of a sudden, it's like I was awake, and I was looking. We had a dresser and the pictures of the kids. And all of a sudden, I noticed there was light. It's like light was pouring into the room, and everything disappeared. The dresser, all the pictures just went out. And so it's just brilliant white light. And this person walked into the room in like a white suit, but it wasn't white. It was more creamy towards gold almost, and walked up. I was so concentrating on the suit, I never looked at the face. He walked up, and out of these clouds, these two rows of these men in white robes with dark hair, he had turned back, and he put his hand toward Helen. He said, "Helen, we've come for you." And of course, you know what I would do then. I sat straight up in bed. I told her about that. And I said, "It looked like the same people in the first dream I saw." And then 3 days later on Tuesday evening, Tuesday the 13th, she died. Just before that happened, I leaned down and I said, "Helen, I love you." I didn't know that her death was imminent. She went, within a half an hour, she died. All the kids were there, and I couldn't speak at her funeral. I just couldn't do it. So Heather spoke, and the chapel and the overflow was just filled to the brim with people. 20 years next month, January 13th.
In the wake of such a massive loss, Tom said that he didn't know what to do with himself.
Afterwards, the kids told me, "Mom says that you should remarry." Eventually, I found a job in Pleasant Grove, and I met this woman from Bountiful. I was really attracted to her, and we got married in 2004 in about May. She was just a little erratic, and I couldn't quite figure out what the problem was. And my kids said to me, her kids said, "We just can't believe that your dad would marry my mother." I said, "Well, it would have been nice if you'd informed me before it happened." About February, after we'd been married maybe 10 months, I came home one night, and she had dinner all laid out on the table. And she was an excellent cook. And she said, "I want a divorce." I said, "You do?" And I said, "Well," said, "yeah, it just isn't working out." So I said, "All right. I mean, I'm not going to stand in your way." I went and talked to my attorney friend of mine in Ogden that was my home teacher that had taught. Meanwhile, I had sold my home in Ogden. Heather said, well, why don't you come and stay with us? So I moved and went and lived with them for, I don't know, from February to May. And one day, Diana called me up and said, Tom, you've got to come back. And the divorce hadn't gone through. I told my attorney to put the divorce on hold. So I went back there. And so June and July, we took a trip to Europe. And come about August, I came home and there was the dinner all laid out. I think we know what this is. So I enjoyed the meal. And she said, I'd like to talk to you. And she said, she had done a couple of things like, she said, I'm going to San Francisco with my daughter and for a few days. And so I said, okay, good. Enjoy yourself. And her daughter was a stewardess. And I called her and I said, well, I ran into your daughter and she's not down there. What are you doing? And she said, well, I came by myself. So it was all a fabrication. So we had dinner number two and she said that was it. And so I said, okay. And I called my attorney. I said, you can go ahead and file that divorce. He said, I know you'll just marry again. I said, don't count on it. Once bitten, twice shy. Eh?
And she was right. It wasn't too long until Tom met Becca.
I moved into the Sacramento 11th Ward and was here for 2 years, retired then in 2010. But in 2007, Becca was in my ward, and I was made the ward clerk. So I knew her sons and everything. And I thought, gosh, I was dating the here and there and people fixing me up. And as a ward clerk, I just was looking over the women in the ward that were single. And I thought, that Becca, she looks really nice. And she was a title loan officer. I was in the mortgage business. And I was up at her office and I said, you know, I've been wanting to ask you out. She said, well, ask me out. And I said, well, as you know, I'm the ward clerk, and I looked at your age, thought I'm just too much older. And she said, well, how old are you? And I said, well, I'm this age. No, you're not. Let me see your driver's license. So I pulled out my driver's license, and she looked at it and said, well, I'll be darned. Go ahead, ask me out anyway. So I asked her out for that Friday. I forget what day of the week it was. So on the 26th of March of 2007, I went with her on our first date and I didn't tell her where we were going. And so she wore high heels and I was a tour guide at the conference center in Salt Lake. And so I took her on an individual tour. Then we went over to the roof of the Joseph Smith building and had dinner. And it was just a wonderful time. She was so easy to get along with. And I've known her for a couple of years and she just seemed solid. His husband, Niles, died when he was 41. Becca was 39. So he died in 1999. So the next morning after that date, I called her up and I said, can I come over and see you? And she said, yes. And so I walked over and she came out. We sat down in the front room and chatted for a bit. And I told her how much I'd enjoyed dinner and that thing. And I asked her if she'd marry me. And she said, yes. So that was 16 years ago, last July 7th. We got married on 7-7 of 07. Two or three months later, her son Colton was just getting ready to graduate high school. Her son Riker was just finishing the eighth grade. So we got married and she moved over here. And we've had 16 years of her retraining me. I went back to work and got a job. My grandsons were working at Liberty Mountain in Salt Lake and Sandy. And I said, Grandpa, you gotta come to work here because they sell camping equipment. He said, ooh. And I decided to go there and worked there for a few years. My son-in-law, you should come down here and drive bus. You can make a lot more money. So 5 years ago, I went down there and started driving bus and have worked there ever since. And they pay me a lot more money. But I just enjoy it. The kids are great. Beck and I have had a good time, and she's just been a great wife, a great companion, and Grandma.
Along with a wonderful, happy marriage, Tom got 5 great bonus kids.
Sam, Alicia, Chris, Colton and Riker. I always told her kids, I said, I'm not your stepdad, I'm your bonus dad. You're not my stepson or stepdaughter, you're my bonus son or daughter. And the kids get along. So I have 23 grandchildren and one great-grandchild. And Becca, she has two great-grandchildren. So we have, I think, 37 children and grandchildren. And they're all just good kids. I was down in the bedroom and I just got this impression about Beck. And I came out here and I said, Beck, you know how I love Helen? Yes. I love you like that. I said, I don't know. I mean, Helen is my eternal companion. And I look forward to the day when I see her again. And I said, but you'll always be a friend through all eternity. And I think Niles, your husband, and Helen are good friends in the hereafter right now.
Tom's love for God and the gospel of Jesus Christ have carried him throughout his life. He says it all began with his faithful mom.
My mother was always active in church, convert to the church, and I was always active. And from the youngest age, I always knew I'd go on a mission. I've been the young men's president 5 times, the bishop, counselor of the bishopric, counselor in the branch presidency in Fort St. John. A high councilman, but mainly youth, camping with the youth, and I love that. And so I have a testimony, and it's stronger now than it's ever been. I just always take to heart, for the wisdom of man is foolishness unto me. I mean, Becca insisted that we have on our license plate, in God we trust. That's who we do. And I've had 3 good women that have promoted my testimony. I've never wavered from that, and I'm grateful. I hope that we've taught our children the same thing, to have a strong testimony. And we just pray always that they'll stick with it.
As you've heard, Tom's life has been anything but ordinary. He's had such a wide variety of experiences. He's remained strong in his faith despite some really challenging times. He's worked hard to provide for his family and be an amazing husband, father, and grandfather. A huge thank you to Amy Warner for purchasing this episode, and to Tom for allowing me to interview him. If there is someone that you would like to have featured on Hearing Our Heritage, email hearingourheritage@gmail.com or visit our website at hearingourheritage.com.